Welcome to the first in our three-part series on Jewish mysticism. Next week and the week after, also we'll have other guest speakers. This week, just for now, I'd like to introduce Dr. Sharon Flato. She's a professor of philosophy and Jewish mysticism at Brooklyn College. She could introduce her topic herself.
Okay, I think I'm going to start by apologizing that I have a very ambitious agenda for this evening, and I guess at some point, an hour from now, we'll stop. This is a very tall order to introduce Kabbalah, and so I'm going to do the best I can. And I gave Rabbi Hittery a handout. You'll see the first page of the handout is an outline. And I thought the outline would help you just follow along with the lecture because, as I said, I am going to cover a lot of ground just to give you a taste, hopefully to whet your appetite. I know this is the beginning of a larger series. I thought I'd do a little commercial for myself. I teach, I teach Kabbalah at Brooklyn College. So if you get excited enough about this topic, you're welcome to come take my course or at least check out the website. The PR department at Brooklyn did a whole website about my course. So you can also, I have an interview there about Kabbalah. So hopefully this lecture will intrigue you in this way. The way I'm going to work this evening is I'm going to go through each of the Roman numerals, and then I will stop and ask for questions. I think the questions in between each of the Roman numerals should be limited to if you have questions of clarification, if something isn't clear, if you need a definition. I think the larger questions will leave for the end, so this will allow me to get through some of this material. Okay, I'm going to start with a brief introduction, which might be a bit disappointing to some of you, discussing what Jewish mysticism is, what Kabbalah is, and more importantly, discussing what it is not. As many of you know, and maybe that's what got you out on a cold Monday night, in the first Monday night in December, Kabbalah has become rather hot as of late. A lot of people are studying it, right, including Madonna, including many other Hollywood stars. The Kabbalah Center is flourishing. And so I want to just, before we start, I want us to discuss what Kabbalah, what Jewish mysticism is and what it isn't. First of all, I want to say that Kabbalah, as of late, has often been used as a synonym for spirituality. If it's used in a positive sense, sometimes people discuss it in a superstition, in a pejorative sense, and they say, it's Kabbalah, meaning it's superstitious, it's not rational, it's magic. And what you'll see from this evening, it's true that no one is denying that Kabbalah does have certain elements of spirituality. So there are certain elements of magic. There is a lot more to Kabbalah than obviously that. And so I want to first talk about why I'm a bit hesitant about this popular phenomenon of what people are calling so-called Kabbalah. And also I want us to enter our discussion with some humility when we are approaching the subject matter. First of all, Kabbalah is extremely, and hopefully this evening we'll have a chance to get to some primary texts. But if not, you'll at least get to look at them at your own leisure. And you'll see that Kabbalistic works are extremely complicated, sophisticated, complex, and it's also a very subtle mode of practicing religion. Well, you'll see there are various aspects to Kabbalah. One is it's a mode of there's text, there's also a way of practicing religion. Second of all, and this will become apparent this evening, it's almost impossible to speak monolithically about the Kabbalah, right? Just as you would never speak monolithically about the philosophers, right? What does philosophy say about X? so too we can't really speak that way about Kabbalah. And as you'll see this evening, there are many, many schools of Kabbalah that emerge in different geographic regions at different time periods. And again, not surprisingly, Kabbalah develops and evolves in various ways and in different ways in different regions, right? Whether it is evolving in Sephardic lands, whether it evolves in Ashkenazic lands. And so it develops and evolves, again, in reaction to various internal developments and in reaction to various external historical trends. So again, it's hard to speak monolithically about the Kabbalah. Another aspect about Kabbalah that I want to emphasize, again, I'm sort of deconstructing what people often call Kabbalah, and what leads me to a certain amount of skepticism when about the contemporary students of so-called Kabbalah, is that while it's true that Kabbalah is, the Kabbalists usually do focus on innovative spiritual dimensions of religious life, Kabbalah often, and this people often ignore, Kabbalists are often working within the framework of halakha. Rabbinic, and as we'll see hopefully this evening when we get to read one of our texts, rabbinic and biblical texts often serve as the framework of Kabbalistic ideas and writings. And that's why it's such a pleasure to often to teach Kabbalah at Brooklyn College. When I get students who have yeshiva background, they can actually, they're ready to start reading some of these texts. So I can't emphasize enough that many, and if not almost all of the Kabbalists, certainly before the modern period, are working within traditional Judaism, and that Kabbalah is not a completely separate dimension of Judaism. It's very much rooted within the framework of normative Judaism. And in fact, one of the big areas of Kabbalistic writings, which has been ignored pretty much until very recently, is there's a whole genre of Kabbalistic writings called Ta'anei HaMitzvot, Kabbalistic reasons for the commandments. So you're already getting a sense that Kabbalah is very much integrated into the structure, the fabric of traditional normative Judaism. And the last point that I just want to emphasize, and again that has been overlooked rather recently, is that Kabbalah was traditionally studied only by an initiated elite. And in fact, the rabbis and also the Kabbalists often stated that Kabbalah is something that's esoteric. It's something that's only to be studied, and this here I'm using the rabbinic phrase, by those whose bellies are already filled with the Talmud and the codes. So only after attaining proficiency in the Talmud, in the entire oral law, in the codes, in the Rishonim, the medieval Jewish commentators, then one was supposed to taste the dessert, study Kabbalah. And so again, I want to emphasize that the only people, right, this is again a very tall order, only those who have mastered the Talmud and the Rishonim would be were allowed or would be equipped to study Kabbalah. That meant, and this is interesting for many of us in this room, that traditionally the only people either who were permitted or who were equipped to study Kabbalah were a select group of educated male elites. And that's something that's important to bear in mind. And also, many of you may know this, the study of Kabbalah was also often restricted to those who were married. And also certain kinds of Kabbalah, especially the hardest type of Kabbalah, Lurianic Kabbalah, was often said to only with people, it was restricted and at various times and places to those who were over 40, right? Many of you might have heard that, that you're only supposed to study Kabbalah when you're over 40. That usually was said about the hardest kind of Kabbalah, and that is Lurianic Kabbalah. So now that you're all scared, right, to touch this material, right? Very few of us have mastered the entire Talmud, and let alone all the other requirements. I want to make clear that from the very beginning, and this is a tension that actually took me a while to sort of get my hands around, but it's clear, and you find it in almost all Kabbalistic writings, from the very beginning, there's a tension in Kabbalistic writings between revealing and concealing the secrets. So you often have within the very same text, within the very same paragraph, that the Kabbalists on the one hand are saying that these secrets need to be limited, need to be restricted, these are esoteric truths that only wise sages can attain. On the other hand, they're writing them down, right? On the other hand, there is this sense that this is the truth with a capital T, and they want to share it. And at least very basic Kabbalistic ideas were meant to be disseminated to a wider audience. And in fact, some Kabbalists go much further. Some Kabbalists claim that it's through the descent. This especially starts with the famous Kabbalistic group in Tzfat, which I'm going to talk about the different historical stages of Kabbalah. But this especially is true beginning with the Kabbalists of Tzfat in the 16th century, and then certainly with the Hasidic movement, the Pietistic movement, the Kabbalistic movement that emerges in the 18th century. There is this notion that the dissemination and popularization of Kabbalah will bring about nothing less than the Messianic Age. So again, there is this tension in many texts between revealing and concealing. So I don't want you all to go home feeling guilty for partaking in some of these secrets. Okay, any questions up until now, or anyone want to leave right now? Okay, so I think before we proceed, I think we need to define the terms. First of all, the terms Jewish mysticism, and then the term Kabbalah. And you'll see in the historical stages that I've mapped out for you, I only start to use the term Kabbalah in 3D. So the question is why? So first I want to tell you, you'll see that academic scholars differentiate between mysticism and Kabbalah. Kabbalah is one form of Jewish mysticism that emerges later. So first I'm going to talk about mysticism, which is the broader category, and then I'll speak more specifically about Kabbalah. So first of all, we have to ask ourselves, what is mysticism? The more basic question before, right, then we can talk about what is Jewish mysticism, and then we can talk about what is Kabbalah, which is one type of Jewish mysticism. So anyone want to give a definition, or when you think of mysticism?
Higher state of mind.
Higher than
consciousness, a different level of consciousness.
Okay.
Perhaps dealing with a form of knowledge that has reason within it, but is not necessarily totally based on logic.
Okay, so we're halfway there. Mystics usually strive to attain a direct experience with God, so the emphasis is on experience that supersedes reason, so what you've said, that supersedes rational comprehension. And again, many people often incorrectly, not our sophisticated audience here, but many people often incorrectly assume that the mystics are anti-rational, anti-philosophical. That's not the case. They just believe that they have to go that extra step, that reason alone is not enough, is not going to lead you to this direct experiential encounter with the divine. And in fact, we'll see that many Kabbalists study philosophy. I thought I'd do a little plug, because I know Rabbi Hidari teaches the Maimonides. And especially they study Maimonides and use Maimonidean terms, but then they believe that you have to go that extra step, Jewish mystics, in order to have that direct experiential understanding of God. So that's the first part of the definition, that mystics try and have the direct experience with God that supersedes reason. But then you have to ask yourself, well, how is this possible? How can one have a direct experience of God, right? What hubris? Or what allows the mystic to believe that they can have this kind of experience? Anyone want to venture a guess? Well, the mystics, and again, here is what makes the mystics rather subtle. They often work with ideas that are found already, the seeds of them are found either in biblical texts or in rabbinic texts, but then they go that extra step. So many of you already have this sense, right, that according to Judaism, the sort of the holiest part of the human being is the neshama, right, the highest aspect of the soul. For the Kabbalists, the neshama is not just the most holy part of the human being, but it is actually a piece of God. And it is this piece of God that humans house that enable or at least allow for the first step of this encounter. We have to talk about what's the next piece of this. So it's not just that the human soul is created in the image of God, but it is actually a piece of God. And again, you can imagine that I'm going to take questions at the end, because otherwise at the end of each, unit. Now, the corollary of this, so that's one piece of this, that the neshama, again, and I'm speaking right now in generalities, it's true, but this is pretty much true for most most Jewish mystical schools. The corollary of this, so right now we've established that the neshama is chelek eloka, is a piece of God, and the corollary of this is still, what allows for this encounter between man and God is that the God of the mystics, and again, this would take a whole semester to flesh out fully, so I'm just, again, speaking very much in general terms, the God of the mystic is not the transcendent God of the philosophers. It's not the God that is removed, the perfect, unmovable mover. That's the Aristotelian term, but it's even the Jewish, right, the Jewish philosophers would depict God as being more transcendent than the Kabbalist will. For the Kabbalist, God is very much immanent, is very much within the world. And again, here we have to be careful. This is not pantheism, even though there are some Kabbalistic schools that come rather close, and people have accused them of that. But still, the Kabbalists are quite careful, even the schools that come closest to that, are quite careful to differentiate that God is within nature, there are aspects of God within the world, and that allows for this connection between the neshama, between the human and God. But again, God is obviously not nature. And then the last point in this definition of mysticism, and again, I'm painting broad brush strokes, is that, and again, this is especially, a lot of what I've said actually rings true to many mystical schools. This is more true for Jewish mystical schools, is that it's, as I said, most of the Jewish mystics are normative, are traditional halachic Jews. But what they do often with the halachot is that they stress various laws and they practice them in a particularly intense way. So for instance, the commandments to love God, to fear God, to cleave to God, which are all found in the Bible, become commandments that are particularly emphasized by the Kabbalists. And in addition to that, they often add certain practices in addition to the halachic norms, especially in the areas of prayer. So many of the mystics employ meditative techniques that will get the mystic into a trance-like state in order to induce a certain type of closeness with God, in order to be able to focus, to have the right kind of kavanah on the divine. So again, I painted broad brush strokes. I see there are questions in the back, and I will take them. But that's just in very broad brush strokes what mysticism is. It's this attempt to have a direct divine encounter with God that supersedes reason, and the reason why this is at least potentially a possibility is because the humans house a divine part, a divine aspect of God, and also the God of the mystics is immanent, and so this also allows for an encounter or the possibility of encounter, and often the mystics get themselves into the right mood for this encounter by stressing various normative practices but in a particular intense way, and also by adding additional practices that don't go against halacha but are what the scholars call anomian. They're neither halachic nor anti-halachic, such as isolation, such as we'll see various other practices. Should I take questions now, or if it's sort of a bigger question, I'm going to wait till the end. But if it's a definitional question, I'll take it now. Yes? The mystics. Right now I'm being very careful. I'm only saying the mystics because the Kabbalists are one form of, yes.
That literally, the soul is literally a piece of God. I mean, I have done some research on and spoken to people about this. And I think some of them are careful when they use this term, telephone time now, they're careful to state that it is Hiroyato.
Right. Well, that's a...
And I think this is very problematic, at least to the non-mystics among us, because this is supposed to, I haven't even spoken to Rabbi Shama, like no Rabbi Moshe Shama from the Sephardic Center, that this is allowed, one is allowed to believe that a soul is literally a piece of God, and he told me this is not the person, this is...
Okay, so I'm gonna stop you here, and then I'll take the bigger question. I mean, this is a general issue with the Kabbalists, and again, this is the issue, that there are tensions in Kabbalah. The Kabbalists say many incredibly daring things, much more daring than the soul is a piece of God, and they often add afterwards, kivyachol, as it were. So again, the Kabbalists are very subtle, sophisticated thinkers. So one has to really do justice to what I'm saying, we would have to really speak about what is the Kabbalist view of God. Right, when I'm saying that the neshama is a piece of God, so we have to do a bigger study here, which I'm not doing. But one also has to be careful of the use of the term kivyachol, because often the Kabbalists use that term, the mystics, as it were, right, that you'll see various aspects of the Godhead are female or male, and then they will say as it were, but on the other hand, they constantly use those same motifs. So they obviously ring true to a certain extent. And again, scholars of Kabbalah debate this ad infinitum, and we can have this conversation afterwards, but I think it's safe to say that some Kabbalah, many mystics do believe that the neshama is a piece of God. I'm going to stop here because I want to get to our definition of Kabbalah, and then let's all be on the same page, and then I'll take the broader questions. So first of all, the term Kabbalah. The term Kabbalah is a Hebrew word from the Shoresh Lekabel, right? Kuf Bet Lamed, and it means to receive. So it means the word. Right now, I'm giving you a literal definition. It means a tradition that has been passed down or received, and that's something that's important to bear in mind. That much of Kabbalah was handed down as an oral tradition. And again, we'll see scholars debate, well, when did it start to be written down, etc. But one has to, again, be more subtle in thinking about this. Even when it becomes a written tradition, it's still often an oral tradition. That you might have had a Kabbalistic text, but the notion was that you were supposed to study it with a master. You were supposed to study it with these elite groups that were studying. So it remains an oral tradition in many ways, even after it's written down. So that's something I wanted to stress. And also I want to emphasize that every time you see the word Kabbalah, it doesn't always mean what we're talking about today, right? I didn't define Kabbalah yet, but in post-Talmudic times, the rabbis often referred to, they use the term Kabbalah to refer to the oral law. Especially the Gaonim, they'll often say Kabbalah v'Yadenu. It's a tradition in our hands. That might mean it's an oral tradition. It's part of the oral law. It's part of the Talmud. So be careful. Not every time you see the term Kabbalah should the red light go off that we're talking about Kabbalah. And again, popularly, and many of you might be aware of this already, popularly Kabbalah is used to define all forms of Jewish mysticism. So you're going to leave this lecture and say, aha, we know what Kabbalah is, and many people are misusing the term. That's true, but still you should be aware that out there, right, in the world, people use the word Kabbalah to refer to any kind of esoteric Jewish teachings, right, the mysteries. You'll see that scholars use the term in a more technical manner. scholars use the term Kabbalah, and again, this is beyond the scope. Tonight I'm just really throwing out a lot of terms and giving you a taste of what this discipline is all about. And I want you to leave here sort of with a more sophisticated understanding, and I'm going to guide you how to continue. But scholars use the term Kabbalah, again, in a more technical sense, to refer to the kind of mystical teachings that emerged in Provence, in the south of France, at the end of the 12th century, and in Spain at the beginning of the 13th century. So it's usually used to define a specific kind of Jewish mystical teaching that emerges in, again, Provence and Spain at the end of the 12th, the beginning of the 13th century. And what's unique, and again, I'm going to get to this at the end of the lecture, but still I have to give you some sense of what distinguishes Kabbalah or what makes Kabbalah different than Jewish mysticism, is the notion of the Sefirot. And the Sefirot, well, the Kabbalists have a unique conception of God, or what the Kabbalists would call the Godhead. And there are two aspects to this understanding of God. One aspect is the concealed part of God, about which you really can't say almost anything because it's beyond human comprehension. And that part of God is called the Ein Sof, the infinite. Literally, the only thing we can say about that part of God is something negative, that it is without end. And then the part of the Godhead that some of you may have heard of, the more popular part, and that might be because that's the part of God that humans can understand to some extent, according to the Kabbalists, those are the 10 aspects of God called the Sefirot. And if you see on the second page of your handout, I gave you a diagram of the Sefirot. Again, I hope at the end of the lecture to get to the Sefirot. But one thing I want to point out, and I think that's often overlooked, is this is only one part of the Godhead for the Kabbalists. This is the part of the Godhead that is revealed. There is the second part of the Godhead, again, the Ein Sof, which is entirely concealed. So that, and here I have to be careful, and I'm giving you an academic overview. The first Kabbalistic work to discuss this kind of conception of God, meaning this conception of God that includes the Sefirot, is a work called Sefer HaBahir. Did anyone ever hear of Sefer HaBahir? Sefer HaBahir, the Book of Light, which emerges, a lot of Kabbalah, by the way, the academic study of Kabbalah is very much at its infancy, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. But this work appears in Provence at the end of the 12th century. Now, much about this work is shrouded in mystery. It seems almost clear that this work was not written in Provence, and it might have been written earlier. But our manuscript, the one we can date this manuscript, the first manuscript of the Bahir, to the end of the 12th century in Provence. And that's why scholars date the beginning of Kabbalah. Right, so Kabbalah is, again, one form of Jewish mysticism. They date it to the end of the 12th century Provence. And if you look at your outline, I'm going to soon go through the different stages, but if you look at your outline, you'll see that 3D is the early Kabbalah. So that's the Kabbalah that includes this conception of the Godhead that incorporates the idea of the Sefirot, which is found in Sefer HaBahir. I know I'm giving you a lot, but I just want to give you a taste. So any questions up until now just about the definitions? Is it clear Jewish mysticism versus as opposed to Kabbalah? Yes.
So there's an implication in the etymology of the Kabbal. Someone had to call it the Kabbal or Kabbalah.
Oh.
So they were implying that they received it.
Okay, for first of all, you're reminding me of my own sins, because I did want to make that, I actually wanted to note that the Kabbalists, how did they even get this term, how did they get the term Kabbalah? The Kabbalists of Provence were aware that the kind of mysticism that they were talking about was different than the kind of mysticism other people had been talking about, and they themselves designated their particular type of mysticism as Kabbalah. And then their students continue to call it Kabbalah, and then obviously scholars of mysticism also continue to call it Kabbalah. So about that term. Yes, but one has to be careful. One has to, and here comes the bigger question, was this a new kind of writing and they wanted to give the illusion that this was an older teaching, or was it indeed an older teaching and they were very much aware of this, and that's why they called it, in fact, the oral tradition, a tradition we've received. So again, those are the big debates out there in the field. I don't want to address them right now, but it is, and I thank you for allowing me to make this point, it is interesting that the first Kabbalists, the first mystics to talk about the Sefirot and the Ein Sof call their work Kabbalah. So they certainly are self-conscious that there's something different about what they're doing. Maybe what's different, again, this is the most conservative read, is simply that they're writing it down. And this is a much older tradition. Yes?
But definitionally, it occurred to me that Kabbalah does not refer to the way this particular knowledge was transmitted to us, but to the form of this knowledge. The knowledge itself is the mystical knowledge of God. One receives, perhaps in a passive manner. And so the term Kabbalah refers to the experience itself, the experiential knowledge of God that one attains. That's what occurs.
The scholars usually use it in a more technical term to refer to the type of mysticism that includes the notion of the Sefirot, the kind of mysticism that you're talking about more, which is focused on the goal, and I'm not speaking about that so much this evening, the kind of Kabbalah that's more focused on the relationship between the mystic and God, with the ultimate goal, which many of you may have heard of as being Divei Kut, that is called in the scholarship ecstatic Kabbalah. But even those Kabbalists are called Kabbalists because they have a conception of God that includes the Sefirot. So what makes Kabbalah unique, if someone's going to ask you, well, what's different about Kabbalah than all other forms of Jewish mysticism or any other mysticism, is this notion of the Godhead that includes this idea of the Ten Sefirot. Okay. So Rabbi Hidari, when he invited me, he asked me, well, I need to know what you're going to do in this lecture. So I told him I'm going to give you a bird's eye overview of the different historical phases, because I think that is something that often is missed. Again, people speak about Kabbalah, and they have the sense that there's sort of one monolithic teaching out there, and don't have a sense that Jewish mysticism has evolved, and there are many different stages and phases of Kabbalah. So that's something that I want to do. Yes?
And you mentioned the parts of it were still very secretive or concealed. Is that, was it only for the elite, or is it concealed?
You're talking about the Ein Sof.
Yes.
The Ein Sof is concealed to everyone. It's beyond human comprehension. The Kabbalists, it's interesting. On the one hand, the Kabbalists have great faith in the power of mankind to understand various parts of the Godhead. But there's also a clear sense of humility, that there are limits to human reason, and humans can't know anything about the Ein Sof. And in fact, that liberated them to be so daring in their discussion.
Who does not? I mean,
the only things humans know is that there is an aspect of God that is concealed. And in fact, there's very little writing that even mentions the Ein Sof, because there's not much to say. Yes?
What's the term Godhead?
The Godhead usually refers to all parts, to both the revealed and concealed aspects of God. So the concealed, the Ein Sof, the revealed, the Sefirot. And the Sefirot then contain, and you see in your diagram, 10 aspects, 10 potencies. These are not attributes of God for the Kabbalists. These are parts of God. This is God. Okay. I'm now going to give you a bird's eye overview of the different phases of Jewish mysticism. Remember, mysticism precedes Kabbalah, and then we'll talk about Kabbalah. But before I do this, I want to acknowledge one of the most important scholars of Kabbalah. And again, if your appetite is whetted at all by this evening's lecture, I hope you go out and either buy some of his books or at least go to your local library. But one of the most important academic scholars of Kabbalah, who's largely responsible for putting this discipline on the map, is the scholar by the name of Gershom Scholem. and he is the one who is largely responsible for mapping out these different phases of Kabbalah, and also for doing pioneering work on the development of Jewish mysticism in each of these stages. Just a little bit about Gershom Scholem. Scholem's deities, he died rather recently. Scholem lived from 1897 to 1982. He first lived in Germany and then made his way to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And again, it's to a large extent the work of Scholem that made Kabbalah into an accepted academic discipline. Up until that time, Kabbalah was viewed by many, especially in the scholarly community, as something that was superstitious, anti-rational, and certainly not worth academic study, not worth serious scholarship. And just to give you a little taste of what Scholem was up against, and maybe what I'm up against, I wanted to relate a little story that is quite revealing. In the 1950s, Scholem was invited to give a series of lectures about Kabbalah at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And one of the greatest rabbinic scholars of the 20th century, Shaul Lieberman, who some of you may have heard of, was the one who got up to introduce Scholem. And he stated in this introduction, so I got a better introduction than this, is that, well, we all know for starters that Kabbalah is nonsense. And we also all know that the study of Kabbalah is scholarship. So I now want to introduce to you the greatest scholar of nonsense. So that was the introduction that Gershom Scholem got. And by the way, I wanted to mention that those lectures, which are certainly not nonsense, at least in my view, were published and became one of the masterpieces of the academic works on Kabbalah, and I definitely recommend it to you, even though it's a very hard read, but very well worth it. That became Gershom Scholem's book called Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism. And if you look at that book, you'll see, at least even if you look at the table of contents, that Scholem covers many of the phases that I am going to mention this evening. So I just wanted to acknowledge my debt, and basically all scholars of Kabbalah's debt to Gershom Scholem. By the way, if you open up the Encyclopedia Judaica, and you look at any entry on Kabbalah, so whether it be on the Sefirot or the Ein Sof or Provence or Tzfat, they were all written by Gershom Scholem. And in fact, there's a very nice book. Someone compiled all of his entries into one book, which is called The Kabbalah. That's also a nice book if you want to get started. Okay, so let me just, again, give you a bird's eye view of the various stages of Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah. So you can't ignore the biblical origins of mysticism. Again, there are not many, but there are a few mystical narratives. Anyone, what are the classic mystical narratives in the Bible? Okay, but even the more explicit, who has the most mystical visions? Ezekiel, right? Ezekiel's vision of the chariot, which is often, people sometimes call it Ma'aseh Merkavah. And so the first chapter of the biblical book of Ezekiel is Ezekiel's elaborate vision of the chariot of God. Other prophets also have visions of God, even though they're less elaborately depicted. Isaiah, in chapter 6, right, sees the throne of God. And Amos, another prophet, also has visions of God. It's interesting, some rabbis claim that really all of these prophets had the same vision, but it's just that they had different verbal capacities, different imaginative skills, so they all depict these visions in a different way, but really they all had the same mystical vision, which, again, is an interesting thing to contemplate. So I just wanted to point out that there are certain mystical origins to mysticism. The next stage of mysticism, which I saw Rabbi Hidariya carrying a book about, is the mysticism that emerges during the rabbinic period. So again, I'm going to loosely define that around the 1st century to the 6th century when the Talmud is closed. And again, I'm painting very broad brushstrokes here. There are this period is characterized by two main genres of mysticism. So again, these genres appear very early on, the first to the sixth century. The first genre is the Merkaba mysticism, the mysticism of the chariot, right? We just talked about Ezekiel's vision of the chariot. And related to this is also the Hechalot literature. The literature of Hechalot means palaces. I'll just, again, tell you very briefly what this is all about. But it's interesting to note that the same period that sees the creation of the Mishnah and the Midrash and the Talmud also sees the creation of this other extreme, more esoteric, mystical genre of writing, namely the writings of the chariot and the writings of the palaces. And what these writings are basically about, it's an attempt of the mystic to have an experience, and especially a visionary experience of God, and especially of God's throne, right? Ezekiel sees God's throne on the chariot. And the way this is envisioned is there's this notion that there are seven heavens, and in each of the each heaven contains a palace. And again, here you really can say kivyachol, right? The mystics don't really think there's seven, but there's an idea that at least the mystic is supposed to contemplate his ascent to see this visionary encounter of the throne of glory. Now, what's amazing about this literature, it seems more and more likely that it was not produced by a group of fringe individuals who are living at the fringes of Jewish society or who were at odds with rabbinic Judaism. But this literature itself depicts itself, often attributes itself to be written by, it probably wasn't, but still it's interesting the way it perceives itself. It's often attributed to Rabbi Akiva, right, who was one of the greatest rabbinic sages, who is certainly known to have had mystical proclivities, and also to another great rabbinic sage, Rabbi Ishmael. So it's interesting, this material, again, is not sort of out there, you know, that they're the rabbis who are sitting around producing the Talmud, and then here are these fringe mystics who are, right, sitting, I don't know, in Judea in the desert on a pole. But again, it seems that these mystics were part and parcel of rabbinic society. So that's one kind of mystical work that's produced in the rabbinic period. Again, the writings of the Merkava, the writings of the chariot, and the Hechalot. I'll just finish this unit and then take question. Another genre of mystical writings that's produced during this period is actually a mystical writing that deals with the other end of things, and that's a mystical work that deals with cosmology, that deals with the creation of the world, and that's the Sefer Yetzirah. Some of you may have heard of this work. It's the Book of Creation, which according to tradition, some traditions, is often attributed even to the patriarch Abraham. But scholars believe, again, it's a very early work. The earliest extant manuscript that we have is from the 6th century, and some scholars believe that it was actually written around the 3rd century. So again, by the way, if you open up Sholem's writing, he has it dated to the 10th century, but since then we've found earlier manuscripts. So again, the study of Kabbalah, the academic study, is still at its infancy, and there are more developments will certainly come about in this field. By the way, what's interesting is if you open up the Mishnah, right, the classic work of rabbinic oral law, there are few disciplines that are restricted, that one isn't supposed to study certain disciplines in large numbers, and two of the areas that are mentioned are Ma'aseh Merkava, the works of the chariot, and Ma'aseh Breishit, works dealing with creation. And it's interesting to note that it's exactly those two genres of mystical writings that we have found from the rabbinic period. So that's something that I wanted to mention. You had a question? Yes?
The genres of the Merkava and the Hechalot, are there specific books or are they just passages that occur in...
No, there are specific books, and there are many, many manuscripts. Again, as I said, much of this work is at its infancy, but there's a whole institute that's thriving in Berlin, of all places, that is publishing many of the Hefalot manuscripts, and a lot of work is being done. Now we're going to take a leap. So that's the first two phases of Jewish mysticism. And now we're going to come to the third phase of Jewish mysticism. We're going to take a leap in forward in time. And that's this pietistic group that some of you may have heard of, who are an incredibly interesting group for various reasons. We're going to focus on their mystical writings. And that's Hasidei Ashkenaz. So again, these are not to be confused with the later Hasidim. This is a small pietistic group that emerged in the 12th and 13th century in Germany and France. They were an extremely ascetic group, were halachic, were normative, but in addition to that, they believed that there was a higher moral law that they had to follow. Again, they were involved in all sorts of penitential practices. But what's interesting for our purposes is that they also had a very sophisticated mystical tradition. And in that mystical tradition, they were very much influenced by the Heichalot writing and by the Merkava mysticism. And in addition to that, they wrote their own work. Some of you may be familiar with Sefer HaChassidim, which was written by one of these pietists, Yehuda HaChassid. So again, I just want to emphasize, these are mystics. The idea of having a direct experiential encounter with God plays a central role for these mystics, but they're not Kabbalists. Nowhere in their writings can one find a conception of the Sefirot or a discussion of the Ein Sof. That will only appear with the writings in Provence, which, by the way, happen at the same time. The Hasidei Ashkenaz are living in the 12th and 13th centuries, but in Germany. Okay, this brings us to the early Kabbalah, which I've talked to you about a little bit. The first Kabbalistic writings emerge. I always joke around with my students that we should take class trips because they emerge in the most beautiful places of the world. The first Kabbalistic writings emerge in the south of France, in Provence, and then they move southward to northern Spain. Some of you, just to throw out some names, might have heard of Isaac the Blind, Azriel of Gerona. And by the way, here again, and I can't stress this enough, we're not talking about fringe groups. The first Kabbalist to write, Kabbalist to write a work of Kabbalah was Isaac the Blind, who was none other, does anyone know who he was the son of? He was the son of the Rizid. Right, the great halachic authority, Rabbi Avraham ben David of Poskier, who wrote his famous Hatzagot, Glosses on Maimonides' Code. So again, we're talking about important rabbinic figures who are not living at the fringes of society by any stretch of the imagination. This brings us to the classic period of Kabbalah. So you are on your outline at 3E. And it's during this period, and again, I hope I'm not offending anyone, I'm just giving you the scholarly view. It's during this period that scholars believe the Zohar, the classic work of Jewish mysticism, the Book of Splendor, was written. Again, according to tradition, and this is a similar point to what you raised before, according to tradition, the Zohar itself presents itself as having been written by the 2nd century Palestinian sage, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, Rashbi. And Rashbi is also a very central figure within the Zohar. But again, most scholars contend that the Zohar was first written down during the last decade of the 13th century. Scholars used to believe that it was written by one Kabbalist, Moses de Leon. The latest scholarship claims that it was written by a group of Kabbalists living in Castile, among whom Moses de Leon figured prominently. Okay, I'm going to, again, just jump ahead so you at least come away with a taste of the different different stages of Kabbalah. By the way, from the 13th century onwards, we're talking about Kabbalah. There are all, there there still is Jewish mysticism without Kabbalah, but even those, many of those who are more inclined to have a more mystical experience still have a conception of the Godhead in incorporating the Sefirot and are still viewed as Kabbalists. So pretty much from the 13th century onward, when you're talking about Jewish mystics, they're also Kabbalists. They also have this conception of the Sefirot. The next major center, and again, if you've only heard of one center, you may have heard of this center. The next major center of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah, is found in Sfat in the 16th century. And here are some of the great Kabbalists. It's amazing who's living side by side in Sfat in the 16th century. So among the Kabbalists living in Sfat are the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Luria, his teacher, Rav Moses Cordovero. I wrote a passage from Rav Moses Cordovero in this packet. And also, and he's often overlooked as being a mystic, but he was a very famous, he wasn't an innovative Kabbalist, but he was very much steeped in mysticism, was Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? The author of the most authoritative code, the Shulchan Aruch, lived for part of his life in Sfat, and also was very much steeped in Kabbalistic teachings. The next phase, so we're close to the penultimate phase, is the phase that where perhaps Kabbalah got the least favorable press, and that's the phenomenon which some of you may have heard of Sabbatianism. Shabtai Tzvi declares himself as the Messiah in the year 1666, and much of the Jewish world accepts him. And again, this is a question again that scholars have spilled much ink over. How did that happen? How is it that most of the Jewish world accepted Shabtai Tzvi as the Messiah? And many have at least adopted the thesis that this has to do with the popularity of Kabbalah in the 17th century. And Shabtai Tzvi very much states himself as the mystical Messiah. He explained a lot of his messianic developments in terms of Kabbalistic teachings, and people believed in Shabtai Tzvi because they themselves were steeped in these Kabbalistic teachings, which had become more popular because of the predominance of the Sfat Kabbalists. So I'll just throw that out there. And by the way, by the 16th, 17th, 18th century, Kabbalah is no longer a restricted elite tradition. It's much more popular. And again, one has to be careful here. Does that mean that sort of every Jew could read the Zohar? Of course not. But does that mean that the idea of the Sefirot and other sort of central Kabbalistic doctrines were known and were included in sermons and were included in the Musar writings, in ethical treatises? And the answer to that is yes. So again, we're not talking about sort of this tradition that was sort of on the side, but it very much was central to Jews living both in North Africa and in Eastern Europe in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. And then finally here, I'll end with perhaps the last phase of Jewish mysticism, or one of the last phases of Jewish mysticism, and that is Hasidut. Hasidism, which again is founded by the Baal Shem Tov in the 18th century in Eastern Europe. And one of the characteristics of Hasidism, and again, many people were very angry at the Hasidim for this, one of the characteristics of Hasidut was to disseminate, again, at least central mystical teachings, which they also felt would have a certain messianic outcome. So, again, and obviously Hasidism, as you know, living where you do in the world, is alive and well, and so is Kabbalah. And so I just wanted to give you this taste of these different phases of Jewish mysticism and Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah. I'm looking at the clock, and then I was just going to talk for 2 minutes about, so what are these central conceptions of the Godhead? What is the Ein Sof and the Sefirot? I don't know. I know the hour is late, but let me just take questions up until now. I know I gave you a lot.
Question about the Zohar. What was it that they were hiding that they did not want to be revealed in the Zohar?
Who's the they?
People. whoever was keeping it from the others. It was not supposed to be discussed or learned. What was the theme that was hidden?
Right. Well, I think we can ask the question in a different way. I mean, those who wrote the Zohar or whenever it was written clearly weren't hiding it, right? They're producing this text, which even if it was only supposed to be read by initiated elite, was still written. So I don't know if you're asking a question about the right group, but what about the Zohar was so daring and innovative that troubled certain people? Well, there are many aspects. First of all, you can sort of ask the question before you ask it about the Zohar, you can ask it about Kabbalah in general. I just gave you this diagram and I just handed it out to you and said, well, this is how the Kabbalists view God. But if you look at this diagram, right, and you weren't familiar with Kabbalah before, in many ways it's quite disturbing, right? The first thing you learn about Judaism is that, right, Jews are monotheists, right? They believe in one God. And, of course, the Kabbalists are monotheists, right? But still, all of a sudden here we have a diagram with 10 aspects. So many of the non-rabbinic mystics, and I'm always careful, the non-mystical rabbis, I'm often careful to say that with my students, because eventually many of the rabbis, if not most of the rabbis, are mystics. Or at least mystically inclined. But the non-mystical rabbis, and certainly many of the philosophers, said, well, this smells of polytheism, right? What are these many different aspects? Or it also smells of perhaps a dualism, right? Because in addition to these 10, there's this notion that there's the revealed aspects of God, and there's the concealed aspects of God. And some have also, again, I would have to talk more about how the Kabbalists view these different aspects, but some also said this smells of Gnosticism, right? One of the great heresies, right? This conception that there are two gods, there are two deities out there, a good one and a bad one, a revealed one and a concealed one. So that's just for beginners, right? So the idea of polytheism, the idea of dualism. Also, what about anthropomorphism? That's probably another thing you learned, right, as school children, right, about the Jewish conception of God, right? You don't discuss God in human terms. Of course, you have that already in the Bible, but you know, many of the rabbis sort of explain that away, that the Torah is speaking in the language of man, right, giving you images that you can understand, but it's not really... That's not the way one is to conceive of man. Well, the Kabbalists get rather explicit in their description of the Godhead in corporeal terms. Again, we sort of need a semester to talk about the different images associated with all the Sefirot, but there are many symbols associated with the Sefirot. The Sefirot are often associated with different parts of the body. And then the Sefirot are also often associated with, again, the female their female Sefirot and male Sefirot. And then there's the notion that you want to try and affect unity within the Sefirot. And the way that's often done is through sexual symbolism. So again, that was seen as being incredibly daring. And that's something that I can answer specifically about the Zohar. The Zohar is very explicit in its use of sexual symbolism, which again was quite shocking and disturbing. But what's interesting, and this is a point that a scholar of Kabbalah, Moshe Idel, makes, is that the Zohar appears around the 13th century, and Maimonides' right classic work of philosophy, The Guide, appears not that much earlier, right? Maimonides dies in 1204. Now, while Maimonides' Guide is very much, and Maimonides, in addition to writing, right, The Guide for the Perplexed, also was the author of one of the classic codes, the Yad HaChazakah, the Mishnah Torah. And even so, the Maimonides' philosophical tract was very much condemned by many of the rabbis, right? There, at certain points, the Guide is burned. It's not clear who instigates it and how that works, but it's certainly, right, the Rashba has a ban that you're not supposed to study philosophy until before the age of 25. So the Maimonides' Guide is a very controversial book when it comes out. On the other hand, Kabbalah, the Zohar, no one seems to ban it. In fact, the opposite is true. So I a little bit would argue with this assertion. The Zohar is pretty much considered a holy work. The Zohar HaKadosh, very early on. And in fact, there a whole tradition emerges where people swear not only on the Bible, but they swear on the Zohar. The Zohar is very much seen as a canonical work, a holy work. Does that mean that people could open the Zohar and read it? Probably not. But still, it's not seen as such a radical work. It's even quoted in certain rabbinic texts. So I don't know if it's almost shocking the extent to which the Zohar is accepted, considering how radical and daring a work the Zohar is and Kabbalah is. Okay, I wasn't going to take the big questions to later, but I see I'm getting them, so, yes.
Would you consider all the prophets that we read about in the Bible, because of their intent to count the Word of God, are they Kabbalists?
Okay, they're certainly not Kabbalists, according to our technical definition, right? Because the technical definition of Kabbalah, as we know from this evening, is this conception of the Godhead that includes the Sefirot. But are they mystics? I think that is the question. And, again, with certain prophets, it's easier, right? Ezekiel, right? He certainly has this mystical vision of God. I'll answer the question backwards, and then we can discuss the question forwards. Certainly, the Kabbalists saw the prophets as mystics. And in fact, I'm only giving you, there's sort of two major trends in Kabbalah. There's only so much I could do this evening. One trend, here I'll throw out a fancy academic word, is called the theosophical trend. And theosophy means a conception of God that includes the spheros. And so that's focused more on God and what God looks like, mapping out the divine. Another trend, and the trend I mentioned before, is called by scholars the ecstatic. The focus there is more on the mystic and the mystic's experience of God. And another term, and that's why I'm telling you this, and then not to confuse you with yet more fancy words, another term for ecstatic Kabbalah is prophetic Kabbalah. And in fact, the ecstatic Kabbalists see it as their goal to attain the state of Dvekut, cleaving to God, Unio Mystica, having this mystical experience of God, which they often define as Nevuah, as prophecy. So they certainly read the prophets that way, right? Who was the greatest of all prophets? Moses, right? Who had the closest experience one can with God, whether at Sinai or God's exclamation that no one is like Moses who sees me face to face. And so he becomes the paradigm of the possibility of mystical experience. So again, do you want to read it that way? I'll let you decide. And do the rabbis, the non-mystical rabbis, read it that already is a more complicated question. But certainly that's how the Kabbalists read the prophets.
When was the
Okay, so again, if we're using this very technical definition of Kabbalah, meaning the Sefirot, this conception of the Godhead that includes the Sefirot, the first work that discusses the Sefirot is Sefer HaBahir. Sefer HaBahir appears in Provence at the end of the 12th century. Well, then you get to the debate, well, was this an older oral tradition that was just written down in the 12th century? And when that actually is quite plausible, because the Kabbalists were very hesitant to write down this esoteric material. And again, according to the Bahir itself, by the way, presents itself as being a rabbinic text. And the Zohar certainly presents itself as being written, right, by Rashbi, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, so being written down in the 2nd century. So according to tradition, the Zohar was composed in the 2nd century. Yes. By the way, that's also an answer to your question. That might be a reason why, even though the Zohar was so daring, people, because they believed that it was written by no one else than Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, one of the greatest rabbinic sages, of course it was sacred, of course it was authoritative. So that might be another reason why these works were accepted as part of the canon. Yes?
When you refer to the centuries, you're referring to current era.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. Okay, are we up for a discussion of the Ein Sof and the Sefirot, or are we falling asleep? Okay, so I... Okay, I got the crab with me. I gotta go. We don't have coffee in the back, I don't know, so... Okay, again, I'm going to do this very superficially. To do this well, you have to come to my class at Brooklyn College, or you have to, even better than that, you have to read Gershom Scholem or other scholars. Again, I could come to me at the end and I could provide reading lists. But let me just quickly talk about these two aspects that I've mentioned in passing and do it in a more systematic way. And also I'll touch upon some of the ideas that Rabbi Hitterieden might teaches in his class on Maimonides. So if you aren't familiar with these ideas and terms, I'm doing a little plug for him. You can take his class on Maimonides. By the way, what's interesting is that the Kabbalists, in addition to often restricting this material, they often don't even have to restrict this material. It's sort of like saying, well, you can't take calculus unless you know arithmetic. Well, that might sound like a harsh rule, but you just can't, right? You can't study physics unless you... So the Kabbalists, and you'll see, we're probably not going to get to the text, but you'll get to look at them at home. The Kabbalists assume a tremendous amount of knowledge. They assume that you're familiar with the Bible. They assume that you're familiar with rabbinic language. And they assume often that you're familiar with philosophical concepts. So you're supposed to know Aristotle, you're supposed to know Neoplatonism, you're supposed to know Maimonides. And so, again, a lot of these ideas are, as a prerequisite, you really need this other knowledge, but I'll try and do the best I can here. Okay, so let's start with the aspect of God that the Kabbalists hardly talk about, because you'll see it's really beyond human perception, but still, to be fair, I do need to say a few words about it. And also, even though the Kabbalists don't speak so much about the Ein Sof, it's one of the most important tenets that underlies the doctrine of the Sefirot. So it's something that we at least need to give a few minutes to. First, again, the Ein Sof literally means infinite, without end. Again, you're going to have to erase some of what I said before. This is the part of God that is transcendent, that doesn't interact so much with the world. The only way it interacts with the world, you'll see, is through the Sefirot. And again, it's entirely unknowable to human beings because it's beyond all human experience. And again, the only thing humans can know about the Ein Sof is what they can't know, right? So the only thing they can know is that it's without end. And again, if this sounds familiar to some of you, this is very similar to Maimonides' notion of the negative attributes, right? Maimonides also has a problem with anthropomorphism, right? What do you do with all the descriptions of God in the Bible? So anyone know what does the philosopher Maimonides do with those descriptions? They're metaphors. You describe them allegorically. And also there's this notion of negative attributes, right? The only thing you can know about God is that God is not kind, right? You can that's the closest one can come to saying anything about God. And so again, the Kabbalists pretty much adopt the philosophical conception of God in their discussion of the Ein Sof. In fact, in some ways, they're more rigorous than the Jewish philosophers, because they say there's nothing you can know about God, and this is the part of God that is completely perfect, that is completely unchanging, that has no will. And again, to do this full justice, we'd have to talk about certain philosophical concepts, which I'm going to leave for another day. But this is the part of God that, again, is completely unknowable, completely concealed. And what this did for the Kabbalists is, in a way, this liberated them. This freed them to talk about the Sefirot in a very vivid, in a very mythic way. Because if they were ever accused of being anthropomorphic or of discussing God, right, using sexual symbolism, they would say, well, this is only the revealed part of God. This is only the Sefirot. And of course, they would also say that these are only metaphors and these are only symbols. But they wouldn't even dare to use those metaphors and symbols in their discussion of the Ein Sof. So that's something that's important to keep in mind, even though you'll hardly ever see reference to that in Kabbalistic text. Okay, then there's the second aspect of the divine, which, as we've talked about, are the Sefirot. These are the 10 aspects or potencies of the divine, which you can see in 4b. I'm not going to go through all of the Sefirot, but I'll just talk about the Sefirot in general, and then maybe we'll get to read one text together. According to the Kabbalists, there's a paradoxical moment when the infinite, right, the Ein Sof is infinite, emanates something that is finite, emanates something that is perceivable, that is knowable, and that is the Sefirot. And the first, so the Kabbalists use different images to discuss this moment. The Ein Sof births the Sefirot, the Ein Sof emanates the Sefirot. Sometimes they use the imagery of light, that these are rays of light which come out of the Ein Sof. Sometimes they use imagery of water. But it's clearly there's this notion here, so if you look at your diagram, that the first Sefirah, the highest Sefirah, is Keter. That is the first Sefirah that comes out, that is birthed from the Ein Sof. By the way, and this is something interesting to note, Keter, the first Sefirah, is seen by the Kabbalists as the most elevated Sefirah. Some even are hesitant to call it a Sefirah because it's so close to the Ein Sof. And another name for Keter, you don't have this on your simplistic diagram here, but another name for Keter is Ayin, is nothing. Because it is so lofty, it is so elevated, that humans can hardly know anything about Keter. So in that way, it's similar to the Ein Sof. Another interesting aspect of Keter meaning crown. Keter is the crown, it's the highest of all the Sefirot, and it's also sometimes perceived as the crown of the Ein Sof, right? You can't see any of the Ein Sof, right? The only thing you can see of the Ein Sof is the crown, right? Is that external, that first piece. By the way, all of the Sefirot are sometimes referred to as Ketarim, as crowns. They're sometimes referred to as garments. In the Zohar, they're often referred to as garments. And that's the notion that this is the revealed part of the concealed God, of the concealed part of God. So they often play with that. These 10 are, of course, one. These 10 are all unified. This, again, is not polytheism. This is monotheism. This is Judaism, right? When the Kabbalists say Shema Yisrael, God is one, they mean it. But they have a different conception. But their conception of God is not the conception that we probably first encountered when we heard about the God of traditional Judaism. The other thing that I need to emphasize is that for the Kabbalists, the Sefirot are God. They're not part of God. They're not a part that you can take away. But they are God. And you understand why the Kabbalists have to say that, because once you can pull one part away and say, well, God isn't always just, right? So just is a characteristic of God, right? Or to use, again, metaphors from the profane life, right? Like you would say, right, your friend is, I don't know, heavy. But it doesn't mean if your friend loses weight, right? She's thin, she's still your friend. She's still who she is. It's not part of her essence, that characteristics. These characteristics are not those kind of attributes. They are part of God's essence. And the reason why the Kabbalist is, as opposed to, even though these are often called midot, so be careful. Another name for the Sefirot are midot, but it doesn't mean the attributes of God that, even though, right.
The difference seems very similar.
Well, the difference is the Nafkamina, right, as you would say, using Talmudic language, is that you can't separate any part of it. You can't say that it's true, God is all of this, except for God is an always mercy. Because the reason, the danger...
We just don't understand how, when something is not merciful...
Okay, so, but the Kabbalists, the Kabbalists would say you can't isolate any of the spherot, because by then you really are creating a system which is polytheistic. Then you are, would be creating a system which could be idolatrous. Again, we don't have much time. Each of these sefirot play an important role for the Kabbalists. Again, the most lofty of the sefirot is Keter. The lowest of the sefirot is the sefirah that maybe some of you have heard of, is Shekhinah. Shekhinah meaning divine presence. Shekhinah is also often associated with the feminine aspects of God. It's also often associated, there are two names for the Shekhinah. Shekhinah is also called Malchut, Providence. And the reason for this is because even though the Shekhinah is the lowest Sefirah in the world of emanation, right, in the world of the Sefirot, she is in a way the highest part of God that human beings first encounter. And therefore, the Shekhinah is often portrayed as being provident, as being the king, the queen, having that kind of direct encounter with people. But again, the Kabbalists are even subtle in their use of language. When I taught at Brown, one of my first year student said this, and I was like, wow, you did that so fast. It was exciting for me. Keter, right, also, I said Keter is the highest sphera, Keter is crown, but Keter crowns the lowest sphera, right, Malchut, the king is crowned. So even with the use of these names, the Kabbalists are alluding to the fact that these ten are one, these ten are a unit, and by the way, this is not a one-dimensional, right, this diagram, the Kabbalists very much see this in three dimensions and more. And by the way, it's not a coincidence that many of the Kabbalists are interested in numbers, and many people who are mathematically inclined also sometimes are interested in Kabbalah, right? Shalom first studied physics and mathematics and then went into Kabbalah. It's very visual, and there are mathematical elements to this. And also, I just want to emphasize something that you don't get on your sheet. This is seen as a dynamic system. There are different unities between these different spherot. And the Kabbalists therefore often use images that are moving, images of water, images of light to talk about the Sefirot. I think that's about as much as I can say al regel achat. I mean, again, there's a lot to say here. Maybe I wasn't going to do this, but since we did get to some of these issues, maybe we'll just look at one beautiful passage about the Sefirot, which in a way touches on many of the themes we've talked about this evening. It's called Water, Light, and Color. It's by Moses Cordovero, so we get to use our outline. Moses Cordovero was one of the most important Kabbalists in general, but certainly in Tzfat. He lived in the 16th century in Tzfat. He's more philosophically inclined. I brought two passages. I wanted you to see one passage by a Kabbalist who's more philosophically inclined. You don't see that as much in this passage, but he's the great anthologizer of earlier Kabbalistic systems. There are also other Kabbalists who are much more mythically inclined, poetically inclined, and you see that in the passage that I brought you from the Zohar. But we're going to look at perhaps what's the easier passage, the passage written by Cordovero. And this comes from his classic work on Kabbalah, the Pardes Rimonim. So who would like to read? Oh, maybe we'll give you, you didn't speak. In the beginning. You, please.
In the beginning, and self-emanated, hence the roads which are of its essence united with it. It and they are entirely one. There is no change or division in the emanator that would justify saying it is divided into parts in these various sefirot. Division and change do not apply to it, only to the external sefirot.
Okay. So here already, and you see this piece is rather polemical, right? The Kabbalists knew what they were up against. What point is he making here?
Well,
Okay, unity, right, between the Ein Sof and the Sefirot, right? This isn't dualism. By the way, I also want to apologize because, as I've told you, we can't really speak about the Kabbalah. As you'll see, Cordovero has a rather unique... Most Kabbalists say that... Many Kabbalists believe that the Sefirot, as I said, are part of God's essence. Some portray it in a more subtle fashion and say that they are vessels for God's essence, and that's Cordovero's viewpoint. That's not the most popular viewpoint, so if I had, I probably wouldn't have picked the Cordovero passage for that point, but it's such a beautiful passage and deals with so many of the other central issues that I did bring it.
Why does he seem to trick, he seems to contradict himself at the end, only to the external Sefirot?
No, well, the division and change do not apply to it, only to the external Sefirot.
Right, so...
He's not...
Certain Sefirot do have a non-unified.
No, he's saying that they're one, but they're different. Obviously, the Sefirot are the revealed part of God. The Sefirot are the part of God that interact with the world. They're the part of God that change. We didn't speak so much about the Kabbalistic conception of the Ein Sof. Part of the Kabbalistic conception of the Ein Sof is that it doesn't change. It's perfect. It has no will. Again, you have to take Rabbi Hittery's class, but that becomes a hairy issue for the philosophers. Well, if God is perfect, then why is there change? Why does he create something at some point? And what about divine will? Does that, if someone wills something at one time and not at another time, does that imply that at stage one it wasn't perfect? So in a way, the Kabbalists have an easier way out. The Kabbalists will just say that Ein Sof is unchanging, is perfect. Cordovero is telling us that. This is an oral tradition, right? I mean, he's not saying anything here that you can't find in the Zohar, that you can't find in the Bahir.
No, but that, if you say the Ein Sof, you don't understand. Now you tell me it's not changing. There is something going on.
Well, that's a negative thing, right? You know that God doesn't change. You know that God is... Right. So that you do know.
By definition?
All right. Now, yeah, the question is a good one, but... That the Kabbalists are willing to stipulate, that the Ein Sof is the part of God that is infinite, that is perfect, that is completely unchanging. There is a paradox, and you're going to get it at some point. Well, then what about the Sefirot? There is the creation of the emanation of the Sefirot. Again, these are the big issues that we need a lot more time. Yes.
I was just going to ask.
Oh, were you the reader and you're asking questions? That's already.
My question was, is this Judaism?
Of course.
Rabbinic Judaism?
Of course. This is the Judaism of Yosef Karo. This is the Judaism of the Vilna Gaon. This is. Yeah, of course. But it's true that some have a hard time with this conception of Judaism. Many are against it. Most aren't, but some are. And then you could see already why it's so daring. And this in many ways is less daring than the Zohar. We don't have here the mythical imagery, the sexual imagery, right? We just have the ideas. Yes?
To help you conceive this, imagine water flowing through vessels of different colors, white, red, green, and so forth. As the water spreads through those vessels, it appears to change the colors of the vessels, although the water is devoid of all color. The change in color does not affect the water itself, just our perception of the water. So it is with the Sefirot. They are vessels, known, for example, as Hesed, Gvura, and Tiferet, each colored according to its function, white, red, and green, respectively, while the light of the emanator, the essence, is the water, having no color at all. This essence does not change. It only appears to change as it flows through the vessel.
Okay, again, we could speak about this, but the hour's late, so let's just finish. It's a beautiful passage. So, and it's also interesting to note that he gives you two images in this piece. So if we had more time, I would say, why two? What's problematic for him about each of these images? Which image do you think works better? But I'll just throw out the questions. Yes?
Better yet, imagine a ray of sunlight shining through a stained glass window with 10 different colors. The sunlight possesses no color at all, but appears to change hue as it passes through the different colors of glass. The colored light radiates through the window. The light has not essentially changed, though so it seems to the viewer. Just so with the Sefirot, the light that clothes itself in the vessels of the Sefirot is the essence, like the ray of sunlight. That essence does not change color at all, neither judgment nor compassion, neither right nor left. Yet by emanating through the Sefirot, the variegated stained glass, judgment or compassion prevails.
Okay, again, this is a very rich text, and to do it justice, we'd need to speak more about the Sefirot, but it is more accessible. If you want to know, if you want sort of the taste of the piece that's less accessible, you get to at home read, again, a very beautiful passage, the conduct of the world through the Sefirot, which is a Zoharic passage, a rather unique Zoharic passage that discusses both the Ein Sof and all of the Sefirot. So you'll get some of the same ideas and some of the ideas we discussed this evening, but again, the Zohar is much more replete with sexual imagery and with all other different kinds of images associated with the Sefirot. Again, this is just to give you a little taste of this very complex and rich tradition that was and has been central to Judaism for many centuries, and for various reasons, whether it's too difficult or because the rabbis themselves restricted it, or because of biases of scholarship, that this was superstitious and anti-rational, has not always been emphasized in the way that it should be. So I thank you for the opportunity to learn this. If you have any other questions, either now or later. Maybe wait, let's grab it.
Okay, I'd just like to thank Dr. Plato for coming all the way out to Brooklyn. I thought this was a great talk. I know I got a lot out of it, and this is going to help me in my future readings. Thank you. And I'd like to invite everybody back next week for a subject that came up a few times tonight, the relationship between the Rambam and the Kabbalah, how the Kabbalists adopted the Rambam for themselves. And that's where Rabbi Labaton is going to be here next week to talk about that.